Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chris Newell, and I'm one of the partners here at the Harbor Group of RBC Dominion Securities. And it's my great pleasure today to be hosting a call where we're going to focus on the impact of the U.S. election on the Canadian markets. And joined with me today is Matt Barish. Matt Barish has been with RBC for 15 years in everly more important roles, and the current role that he's focused on now is the Chief Canadian Equity Strategist for RBC Capital Markets, and he's currently responsible for providing RBC Capital Markets' view on the Canadian equity market, and he shares this through the research channel that Dominion Securities participates in. I'm also joined by my colleague Robin Gullison, whom I think needs no introduction for today's call. He is the lead strategist here at the Harbor Group of RBC Dominion Securities. We're focusing today on the U.S. election. We think it's timely, and it's one of these topics that we're getting questioned by clients on a very regular basis, ranging from views of it could bring substantial volatility to the infrastructure spending will be fantastic, and this will be a boon for Canada. In keeping with recent conference calls that we have, we're going to do this in a question and answer format. So I will now hand it over to our lead strategist, Robin Gullison, who will ask questions of Matt Barish, whom again is the lead Canadian equity strategist for RBC Capital Markets. And what will ensue will be an interesting dialogue around the U.S. election and implications for Canada. So Robin, without further ado, I hand it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Chris. And thanks, everybody, for dialing in. Matt, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. So, Matt, I'll just get right into it, I guess. You know, question number one, I think that a lot of people have is, you know, could Trump actually win the election? What are the polls saying, and what does the Electoral College look like? I know that, you know, the popular vote is one thing, but all the states, some states are a lot more important than others, and I know you're pretty well versed in that sort of thing. So if you could take us through what you're seeing there, that'd be great.
Sure, and thanks for having me on today. So, you know, a couple things here. I mean, first of all, if we go back a week ago, you know, just before the debate between Trump and Clinton, you know, things have clearly changed here, and I don't think that's going to be a big surprise to, you know, maybe anybody who watched the debate or who has seen some of the coverage post-debate. You know, the election looked quite narrow a week and a half ago, but maybe not as narrow as might have been portrayed by some. But that has widened out quite significantly since that debate. You know, what we're looking at right now, and you can get a lot of this information yourselves, you know, via websites like 538.com. And basically what they're saying right now is that Hillary Clinton is probably looking at somewhere around a 70% chance of winning the White House in November, which is not 100%, so I think that's important for people to keep in mind. But certainly her odds have dramatically increased here in the last week or so. One thing I'll say on this is that, you know, as most of you or all of you know, the U.S. has a different electoral system than really anybody else in the world uses, and that's the Electoral College system for the presidential election. And that Electoral College system makes things a little less clear-cut than, you know, simply a majority poll might suggest. So even though Hillary Clinton's overall lead in the polls is probably anywhere from 3 to 5 points, that probably doesn't do complete justice to, you know, how big her lead probably is at the present time. And what I mean by that is, you know, basically there's 538 electoral votes at stake, and almost all of them, you know, 90%+, actually 529 out of those 538, they are all winner-take-all electoral votes, which means that if you win one more vote in a given state, you win all of the electoral votes of that state. There are two exceptions, but they're, you know, Nebraska and Maine, which don't have a lot of electoral votes. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's pretty much a winner-take-all contest state by state. And if you look at it from that perspective, Hillary Clinton starts with a much bigger advantage than a simple poll might suggest. And just to put that in perspective, you know, she needs 270 electoral votes to be president. If we look at the last six elections, Democrats have won in all six of those elections the same 242 electoral votes coming from 19 different states, meaning in the last six elections, there's been 19 states that have voted Democrat every single time. If she simply carries those 19 states, and she currently leads by a substantial margin in virtually all of them, she's basically already got 90% of the electoral votes she needs to be president. To put it in perspective, if she won those 19 and she won Florida, for example, she would be president of the United States. Now, it is possible, of course, that Trump flips over one or more of those states, but it's not an easy task by any stretch of the imagination. And just to put it in perspective one more time, and then I'll stop talking because I can be a windbag. I apologize for that. But, you know, if we look at the 2012 election and give Donald Trump every single state that Mitt Romney won, except for one, we take North Carolina away from him, and the reason we do that is that polls suggest in all likelihood she's going to win North Carolina by at least a few points. So if we give him everything Romney had, take away North Carolina, but give him Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania, so give him all of the big swing states that everybody always talks about, if we give him all three of those and we give him New Hampshire and New Mexico, which are firmly in Clinton's camp right now, but let's say he somehow managed to flip them, he still would not have enough votes to be president of the United States. So it's a very tall task. I mean, that would get him to 267, so he'd still be a couple of votes shy of the number. It's not to say that it's impossible, but it's just important to note that the math is very – it was already very challenging coming into this, but given what's happened in the last week or so, it becomes all the more daunting. Not impossible, but challenging.
Thanks for that, Matt. And I guess the reason we're on this call is because Trump has defied the odds kind of all the way through this process since he came down the gold escalator, I guess, a little over a year ago now. And so, like you said, the chances are pretty slim, but I think people are, you know, the concern is that he defies the odds once again. And to that, you know, the reason the odds are supposed to act against him, I think, is he said a lot of very controversial, let's say, things in the campaign trail. And, you know, you did some good work in your research piece that we now have posted on our website for anybody on the call who wants to take a look. And you kind of talked about what's the probability of the things the campaign says becoming law. Can you go into that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so one of the assumptions that we had when we wrote the piece was that if Donald Trump were to win, you know, so if we start with that as kind of the base case, let's say he does win, you know, first of all, we assume that if he wins, it comes with the Republicans continuing to control both the House of Representatives and the Senate. They currently control both. They control the House by a wide margin. They control the Senate by a margin of 8 seats at the present time. However, the upcoming election, of the seats that are being contested, and there are 34 seats that are up for election, roughly 2/3 of those are being defended by Republicans. So even though they have a fairly sizable majority at the present time, they have a lot more at stake in this election than the Democrats have. So, you know, them winning the Senate, at least by some, has been, you know, questioned. And if you look at current polls, they're fairly close to 50-50 as to who will control the Senate post November 8th. However, we assumed that they would continue to, largely because we think it is quite unlikely that if Trump were to win, he would not also carry down ticket in terms of Republican support. In other words, if Republicans turn out, and that's what's going to need to happen for him to win, it's unlikely that he does that and somehow there's not enough of a turnout to support a Republican victory in the Senate. So with that in mind, if Trump wins, we assume it will be a united government in the U.S. In other words, that the Republicans will control all three houses of government. And as a result, his agenda, and I grant that his agenda is somewhat sparse on details. I mean, you can go to his website and see what sort of his main policy outlines are, but he doesn't provide a tremendous amount of meat to them. But that said, if you kind of take the headlines and you assume that the Republicans control everything, then there's a good chance that a fair bit of his agenda will get through. Now, some of these things stand to be quite positive for Canada. You know, if you take sort of the big ones, which are an enormous cut in both personal and corporate tax rates in the U.S., as well as a repatriation tax holiday, which would allow a lot of U.S. corporations to bring a lot of money back from overseas that they currently cannot access. If you take those together, the push that it would provide to the U.S. economy would be quite large. And considering 75% of Canadian trade still goes to the U.S., a stronger U.S. economy is going to be reflected in the Canadian economy in all likelihood and probably quite meaningfully. Now, there may be some long-term negative repercussions of this, and we kind of touch on that. I mean, look, right now one of the big competitive advantages Canada has is a favorable corporate tax rate relative to the U.S., and Trump's plan would wipe that away. Also, if you look at personal tax rates, I mean, Canada already has marginal tax rates that are significantly above those of the U.S., and if Trump's proposal were to become law, that gap would get even wider. So in terms of, you know, competitive positioning for talent, that also could be put at risk in the long run from Trump's plan. But it's our feeling that, you know, anything that lifts the U.S. economy and potentially quite meaningfully in the short run is going to be quite positive for Canada, at least for a time. So from a tax cut perspective, that would be positive. And the likelihood of getting that through a Republican Congress, and you know, not necessarily in its 100% absolute form, but getting it through largely intact would probably be quite high. In addition, he also has a plan for infrastructure spending, and again, the details are quite sparse. But, you know, if you added that to the kitty, so to speak, that also would be quite positive for Canada, just in terms of what it would do for not only the U.S. economy, but, you know, by extension, a stronger U.S. economy generally translates into higher demand for commodities. And that generally works out positively for Canada and the Canadian stock market. Now, the likelihood of all getting tax cuts and infrastructure spending through Congress might be a little more challenging. There are a lot of hawks in the Republican Party, and you know they will fight against the, you know, anything that balloons the deficit. So I don't think that he ends up with all of that happening, but let's just say that directionally, it's going to be positive for the U.S. economy and should help Canada. Now, there are obviously some policies there that are more negative for Canada, and the big one is trade. One of the things I would caution folks on as far as trade and immigration are concerned is that, you know, whereas he's got to go through, or the president has to go through Congress for tax cuts and spending increases because Congress ultimately controls the purse strings, his ability to work around Congress when it comes to things like free trade and immigration is considerably greater. A lot can be done in the U.S. through executive order, which Congress can ultimately reverse, but it takes a lot of work for Congress to reverse executive order. So he could sign documentation that basically says, you know, we are altering our immigration policy or we are altering some of our free trade agreements. And there could be a period of time there where, you know, before Congress, if it decided to act, would be able to act, and that could be quite negative for Canada. So there's puts and takes to be sure. I mean, in the long run, we think that the ultimate impact of things like tax cuts will be net positive for Canada, at least for a time. And as a result, you know, we see the benefits before we necessarily, you know, start to think about what some of the downside may be. But, you know, it is important to note that there is a bit of a different dynamic between you know, what he can get done quickly through executive order and what may take him a little more time as he's got to go through Congress for it.
Okay, great. And as far as just general market moves go, as far as, you know, what happens to the stock market on week one, the Canadian dollar, interest rates, do you have strong views there?
Well, on some of them, and I don't know if I'd say strong views, but views. So first of all, it's important to note that if Trump's victory is truly a surprise on November the 8th, there is a chance that that's going to elicit a negative market response. However, the market generally is going to have an idea as to who's going to win ahead of time. You know, if we look back over the last 60-plus years, there have not been many presidential elections that were actually surprises on election night. We generally have a pretty good idea, despite what the pundits may say in the lead-up to the election, as to who's going to win. And just to put that in perspective, you know, if we go back to 2012, 88% of conservative pundits predicted that Mitt Romney would win the election, and he lost the election by 4 points. So I would be very careful listening to the pundits as we head into Election Day. Listen to the polls before you listen to the pundits. That said, should he win and should it be a surprise on Election Day, we do have some data to go on as far as, you know, the last 60 years. There have been some elections, five of them, in fact, where we did not know who the victor was going to be with any degree of certainty on election night. And those elections were, the 1948 election, the 1960 election, the 1976 election, and then the 2000 and 2004 elections. If we compare those elections to those elections where we had a pretty good idea of who was going to win and they did in fact win, there is a pretty meaningful difference in performance, especially out of the gate. You know, that first month performance in those five surprise elections has been decidedly worse than the performance of markets when we have known with some degree of certainty who's going to win. And I think Trump victory, just given, you know, that some of the feelings that he elicits in folks, I think there's a risk that should he win on November 8th, we could see a potential negative reaction by markets and perhaps one of some magnitude if that were to occur. Now, we would view that, all else equal, as probably a chance for investors to add exposure to the stock market. Again, because we think on the whole, you know, his economic policies will lead to, you know, quite strong performance, at least for a time. It really is dependent on his victory being an out-and-out surprise on Election Day, which, as I said, often polls will get ahead of it. As far as the other issues of currency and things like that, we think a Trump victory would be quite bullish for oil. His policies are going to, certainly from a Canadian perspective, you know, some of the big negatives that we have here in Canada is that, you know, look, we have a lack of takeaway capacity for our oil, and that's primarily a pipeline problem. It's not as bad as it was 5 or 6 years ago, but Keystone XL and projects like that, if were they to be approved, would be positive for Canada just from, you know, that issue of takeaway capacity. And price realizations in Canada are lower than they are pretty much anywhere in the world when it comes to oil. And again, that's really an issue of getting our oil to where, you know, it needs to be and where the refineries are. And Trump's policies certainly speak to opening that up to some degree. So that would be positive directly for Canadian oil. And then, look, a stronger U.S. economy is generally going to be positive for oil prices. We haven't actually crunched the numbers, but you're probably looking at a pretty meaningful demand lift for oil were the U.S. economy to get, you know, some of the tax relief that has been outlined. And again, that would probably help prices. Now, in the long run, Trump's plans would certainly indicate more oil supply down the road. So, you know, there might be some longer-term negative implications for oil, but certainly in the short run over the next couple of years, we would view it quite positively. As far as the Canadian dollar is concerned, and this will be a little contrary to what I just said about oil prices, and, you know, and it's our currency team's view that, you know, all else equal, if you were to get a repatriation tax holiday in the U.S., the last time we saw something like this was 2005, and it led to a pretty meaningful rally in the U.S. dollar against pretty much all currencies. It creates a tremendous amount of demand for U.S. dollars, at least over a short period of time. So there might be a window here if the market started to price in that repatriation holiday where the U.S. dollar would strengthen. In the long run, oil prices would probably help the Canadian dollar, but, you know, certainly there might be a short-term window here where, you know, that repatriation holiday boosts the U.S. dollar, at least for a time. Anyway, I'll leave it at that unless there was anything else you wanted me to comment on with that one.
Well, I guess the last one would be on interest rates. If they're going to do massive tax cuts and potentially infrastructure spending, I assume that's going to lead to larger deficits and stronger growth that lead to higher interest rates. I mean, I know all has been looking for higher interest rates for a long time and it hasn't happened, but maybe this would be it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you make a good point there. I mean, I think there's probably been a prediction of higher interest rates by most of the street at some point in every given year over the last 10 or 15 years, but certainly, if we got this kind of reductions in taxes coupled with any sort of increase in fiscal spending, and this would lead to some fairly large – it would lead to good growth, but it would also lead to some fairly large budget deficits in the U.S. You know, there's been one estimate in particular that, you know, kind of puts the 10-year addition to you know, net deficits at something on the order of, you know, $2 to $4 trillion. So it's quite a substantial amount of money. And in our view, this would probably push long-term interest rates higher and perhaps meaningfully so. And considering we're starting from a very low base, you know, any increase in basis points on interest rates is, in percentage terms could be quite substantial. So, our view would be that, yeah, if you're ever going to get higher rates, this is the sort of thing that would lead to it, because this kind of deficit spending historically, you know, has been inflationary and has been something that has led to higher interest rates.
Okay, and I guess on a sector basis, so things that have been very interest rate sensitive, like things like utilities, telcos, REITs, et cetera, at the margin, those would be negatively impacted.
Yeah, so there would be some offsets, to be sure. So I don't want to say that anything is entirely going to be tilted one way. You know, so from a utility perspective, you know, Trump is fairly – not even fairly. He's pro-coal. He's pro-infrastructure spending. So from a utility perspective – coal by far remains the cheapest input cost, so, you know, any president that's pro-coal is going to be helping from a margin perspective the utility industry, along with, obviously, the coal industry. In the case of the REITs, you know, you would have offsets from stronger U.S. growth. Stronger oil prices would also help the Canadian REITs because, you know, obviously they've been having a lot of issues in Alberta. So if we did get a lift in oil prices, that would help to offset some of it. So it's not an unadulterated negative for these sectors just from higher rates, but, you know, all else equal, they're probably going to be relative underperformers versus some of the other areas of the market, such as energy, materials, financials from a steeper yield curve. So, you know, if you want to think of it in terms of absolute and relative winners, they'd probably be, in absolute terms, they'd probably do okay, but in relative terms, they'd probably struggle.
That's great. I guess we have one final question here. We haven't really talked about what happens in the 70% scenario they're currently predicting if Hillary wins. Is that just Obama term three, or do you think there's some subtle differences there that'll affect the markets?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some subtle differences here. I'd make a couple of points here. First of all, it's important to note from a Canadian market perspective, United U.S. government has been historically far better for Canada than has divided U.S. government. You know, if we look back to World War II, and if we look just at the years in which the U.S. has had a united government, so, you know, all three houses, you know, both houses of Congress and the White House controlled by one party, the average outperformance for the TSX versus the S&P 500 is about 500 basis points per year. Conversely, when we look at divided government, so when, you know, it's a Democrat versus a Republican Congress or vice versa, that flips 180 degrees. So the underperformance for the TSX is 500 basis points per annum. You know, part of the reason for that is it's harder to get things done in terms of spending plans or tax cuts or anything like that when there's divided government. I know a lot of people talk about how, you know, a government that does nothing is generally a good government, but history doesn't actually bear that out the way that that you might think, at least in terms of stock market performance. So if we imagined a Hillary presidency and the Republicans at least continuing to control the House, and there are not too many scenarios where they don't continue to control the House, regardless of what happens in the Senate, we end up with that divided government outcome. So historically speaking, that's not necessarily a good thing for Canada, at least on a relative basis. Besides that, I mean, look, is it simply four more years of what we've seen with Obama? Probably for the most part. That said, you know, Congress has been recalcitrant for the last 8 years as far as Obama is concerned. It's hard to imagine them getting less stubborn in the face of Hillary Clinton becoming president. So, you know, is it possible things get even more gridlocked than they already are, especially with one and probably a couple more Supreme Court seats coming up in the next few years. So it might be one of those things where it's kind of a worse version of this inertia that we've had for the last 8 years. And I would note as a final point, we're in need of something, I think, from a kind of global growth perspective. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. You know, we push monetary policy here pretty far worldwide, and it doesn't mean that there's still not more that monetary policy can do, but at some point we need fiscal policy to be a helper in all of this. And, you know, for the last 8 years, or really the last 7 years, we've lived through a period in which monetary policy pretty much had to do it by itself, but it had a lot of tools at its disposal, whereas today monetary policy doesn't have nearly as many tools at its disposal because a lot of them have been exhausted. So for it to continue to do it by itself going forward, that's probably going to become more and more challenging, and fiscal is really going to become that much more important. And so if we enter into a period in which that, you know, sort of gridlock that's existed the last 8 years in the U.S. continues to exist, you know, I think the impact of it becomes greater than it has been the past 8 years. We were able to get through it the past 8 years because we had monetary policy really working hard, whereas in the next 4 or 8 years, because monetary policy has been largely exhausted, we're going to need it. And that is a concern for sure, not an endorsement in any way of Donald Trump. I don't want that to come out of this, but it is something I think that we need to think about.
Great. Well, with that, we'll wrap it up. Matt, thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you everybody else for dialing in. We will have a recording of this call on our website, and we do have a copy of Matt's article on the website if you want to get into it a little deeper. We'll have our next call in a month, and we look forward to speaking to you then. Thank you.